We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the program, Harriet Williamson, Kyle Mabry, is at the controls. Over the past 3-4 years, more than 20,000 people across Mexico have lost their lives to violence connected one way or another to the drug trade. And while this violence doesn't happen everywhere in Mexico, it does happen mostly along the border between Mexico and the United States. Our guest for this hour, a journalist, Ed Volumi, traveled along that border. In fact, he traveled twice along that border from the Pacific on the one side to the Gulf of Mexico on the other, in an effort to try to understand this region and this violence. And it's a place that he says is a country in its own right that belongs to both the United States and Mexico, and yet to neither. That's an idea that he tries to get at in a new book that he's authored, and you can see from the title he is suggesting that it is a place that is something of a blending of both. The title of the book is A Mexica, and the subtitle is War Along the Borderline, and it's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and it's just come out. Our guest, Ed Volumi, was New York correspondent for The Observer, the British newspaper. That was from 1997 until 2003. And he also spent many years as an international correspondent for The Guardian. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and we're pleased to have him with us. Questions are welcome. We do ask people who call in to try to be brief and stay on the topic. That way we can make room for as many different people as possible, but we'd certainly welcome you into the conversation. 333-9455 is the number for Champaign-Urbana, here where we are. There is a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And you also can send an email, and you can write to will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point, your questions are certainly welcome. And Mr. Volumi, hello.
Good morning to you.
Thank you very much for talking with us. We certainly do appreciate it. I understand that you first set out that the project that then grew into A Mexica was not really going to be about the drug war along the border, that what you intended to do was write something about the border and about trucks and trucking. How is it that you started there but ended up with A Mexica?
Well, yes, the horror that you've described, the numbers some say reach something like 28,000 dead now since December 2006, and many of them in horrific ways of almost perverse ingenuity and cruelty. but no, this started for me, David. I wanted to write a book and call it A Mexica about the phenomenon of the borderland and all its contradictions. It started off, indeed, to do with trucking, as you say. I went down in 2001 to do an article about, people may remember, it was a window at the beginning of the Bush, George W. Bush's first presidency, when he wanted to introduce and allow Mexican trucks and truckers into and throughout the United States. Instead of the shuttle system that operates at the moment, where American trucks go and pick up this massive volume of goods from the border, it didn't last long. 9/11 put pay to it, but I was fascinated by the contradictions of the borderland. This frontier, which is harsh, it's a line in the sand or across the river, needs must. It's even more so now, and yet it's also porous. It's the busiest commercial border crossing, the border in the world. 1 million people a day cross it to go to school, to shop, to visit relatives or family, it's porous too. It's a series of contradictions. It's where these two countries meet, and the whole is so much greater than the sum of the parts. Again, these are contradictions. The smile is warm, the welcome ready, and this becomes more so the worse the violence gets, oddly. So, you know, a place of light and shadow, work and laughter, and it fascinated me as a place. So what I've tried to do is a write a book which is about a place in time of war. The violence really started in 2005, escalated dramatically in 2006, and we're in now, I'm afraid to say, looking down into a murderous abyss for Mexico with this drug-related war. And there's no end in sight, no bottom in sight yet. So in a way, the war appeared and dictated the framework of the book.
You have actually been a war correspondent. So I am interested in whether you think that the war metaphor that we use to talk about drugs, illegal drugs, and we talk about what is going on here in this region is appropriate or not.
Yes, it's a good point, David. Thank you. I mean, some people who live there think war is the wrong term. And yes, I've been a war correspondent. And again, the wars always find me. I'm a bad guy to hang around. I went to Italy in 1990. I was told to keep an eye on Yugoslavia. So I ended up 3 years in Bosnia and Croatia covering the wars there, keeping an eye on Italy. And then I came to New York to try another attempt at the Dolce Vita and moved into an apartment 20 blocks north of Ground Zero. So next thing I knew, I was in Iraq. So you know, these things find me. I'm cursed and blessed in this way. But no, war, yes, of course, it's not a war in terms of front lines or no man's land in between front lines. There is, and we can come to them later possibly, there is now a narco militia, a paramilitary army, if you like, that works with the Gulf cartel called Los Zetas, which is probably, arguably anyway, one of the most terrifying criminal syndicates in the world at the moment and has a sort of trump card in what's going on in Mexico. But war is, you know, is something that changes with time, and there are characteristics to this conflict, this violence, if you like, and I think we can call it a war. 28,000 to 30,000 dead in 3 years is too much to call a civil conflict, I think. And you know, the kind of weapons that are involved are weapons of war: armored personnel carriers, rocket launchers, heavy machine guns, Kalashnikovs, AR-13s, modified, and so on. these are weapons of war, and in a way, the novelties of this violence gives us some idea, more generally speaking, about where warfare is going. It's about essentially nothing. It's about drugs. It has no ideology. It has no cause or window dressing or pretense of a cause. But I think we can call it a war. Yes, I think we have to.
And it's really it's odd in a way for so many of the combatants in this war that it becomes more bloody and consequential the smaller the stakes become.
Well, and this is a crucial point. I mean, I, and the stakes are horribly small. This, in a way, is the nihilism and the decadence of what's happening in this violence, and I suspect probably explains its grotesque cruelty in some cases. And you know, don't want to spoil people's morning coffee, but I mean, you know, we're talking about decapitations, we're talking about terrible torture and mutilations, we're talking about, you know, a face sewn to a soccer ball, severing of limbs and torsos and so on. But let's not go too far down that road. But yes, crucially, when you see the headlines and when you hear the news bulletins, and it's well reported by some very good journalists working down in Mexico City. And it's the thumbnail sketch of the conflict. It's a war between cartels for the smuggling routes for drugs into the United States, and that is the immediate root cause. Yes, but what I found in these journeys zigzagging the border is that it's different from place to place for sure. But what it is for above all are these tiny patches of turf or the plazas for the local drug market. What's happening is I think an insufficient concern to the United States, and it's almost taboo in Mexico, unforgivably, is that, you know, where the river runs through, people will drink. And these communities on the Mexican side of the frontier, and we're talking about places that are 15 minutes walk from the United States, but from Texas, Arizona, and Southern California, are ravaged by hard drugs. We're talking of terrifying concoctions: crystal meth, methamphetamine, crack, heroin, and the riptide beneath this, I think, is probably in many ways economic, social, but what you've got now is a sort of implosion of society, a fragmentation of the cartels in places like Ciudad Juarez, opposite El Paso, which is by some counts the most dangerous city in the world now. And it's street gangs, it's the corner, it's killing for almost nothing, killing for the fun of it, killing for this little tiendita where the drugs are sold on that corner, this colonia, this barrio. The stakes get lower, the violence gets worse. And there are terrifying conclusions, I'm afraid, to draw from that, I think.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Ed Volume. He was the New York correspondent for The Observer, the London paper, also spent many years as an international correspondent for The Guardian, and has been spending time now for a couple of decades, I think, actually, along the border between Mexico and the United States, traveling there, talking with people, writing about it, and his book that explores the border. This region he titles A Mexica, and it is recently published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a caller here in Belgium, not far away, line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning, Mr. Inge, and your guest. As Mr. Inge knows, I have a particular view on this. And when you say there's no cause to that war, sir, I disagree heartily. There's definitely a cause for that war, and that is money. It's treasure, just like many other wars. The people who are pushing the combat don't care about the drugs. They want the money, and they're going to get it by any way, shape, or form. And it is our fault here in America to allow drugs to be handled the way they are still with the stupid laws we have. Let's change the money. Get the money out of it. This will disappear. All they want is money.
Well, this is something that comes up every time that we talk about this subject, and we certainly have before, and not just this caller. I think that there are other people that would make the argument that, yes, if this is something that we want to solve, we need to do that by acting on the demand side here in this country primarily, and that the answer to this violence is either decriminalization or legalization of these drugs. What do you think about that?
Well, I'm grateful to you, sir, for bringing this up. Yes, of course. I mean, it is about money. You're quite right. And and in a sense, I suppose one could say that if you strip away some of the crazy causes that people have fought wars for over the decades and centuries, so many of them are about money. What I was trying to introduce before we get onto the decriminalization argument, was to introduce that so much of the killing. There does not appear to be very much money to be made. I was particularly struck by these massacres of children in the rehab centres, trying to kick these awful habits. You get nasty flashbacks. I went into one just a few hours after one of these massacres happened. 10 people killed in a place called the Anexo de Vida in Ciudad Juarez, Annex of Life. Not much life in there when we went. Why does a death squad need to go into a rehab centre run invariably by pastors or priests? And wipe out teenagers trying to kick the habit. there are pointless murders of the children who clean the windscreens at traffic lights or hawk newspapers. There is something else going on as well as the point you quite rightly raise about money. And as regards this, yes, we've come straight into the 500-pound gorilla that always sits in the room, which is a question of legalization. journalists, I think, change their mind about things too often. But sometimes it can be a bit like Columbus. You go looking for Indian, find America. And I set out on this journey believing, as you say, that the answer, or at least one of the answers, one of the steps that should be taken, is to decriminalize or legalize drugs. I am agnostic about this. Sorry, not as a cop-out. I've just tried to think it through. I think that in the constituencies that argue for legalization, there can be a sort of misunderstanding about why people take drugs, or why most people take drugs. This word recreational comes up, that it kind of makes the party go with a zing, makes you feel horny, makes music sound better or whatever. But that's not really why these wretched people in these wretched places take drugs. And can we just exempt marijuana, by the way, from this? I'm talking about hard drugs. And I've got a fear. I mean, people take these drugs to obliterate themselves, for reasons that are destructive and self-destructive. I've got a fear that if we were, say, to regulate a form of crystal meth or crack that our children could go out and buy at Rite Aid or Walgreens, and it's sort of messed up your brain 65%, and it costs $5 a hit, I don't really think these. I think there will always be people who will look for a form of that drug that messes your brain up 95% and costs $1.50 a hit. There's a sort of optimism about the reasons why people take drugs in the argument. I'm not saying you're wrong, sir, about decriminalization. I just think that it isn't as black and white as that. I don't think legalization would necessarily take the money out of it. Mm. What you can do, just if we're going to get to sort of solutions before we've just really discussed the problems, which is what we're doing, is to go after that money. There was a settlement earlier this year by a bank that admitted to failing to monitor properly some $110 million that was directly proven to be connected to the four big cocaine shipments, and hundreds of billions of dollars that were coming through these exchange houses in Mexico to which the proper strictures weren't applied. If you go after the money with a little more gusto, then I think you do start to throttle the business. But I think that decriminalization doesn't necessarily take that money out of it. Not necessarily. Maybe some of it, but not all of it.
Just one other point real quick to come back to something that you really have touched on. I think as we think about the problem of illegal drugs, often we think, as we think about the typical user, we think of people who are relatively affluent, middle class or above, and people who are using them for, as you say, we'll put it in quotes, recreational use, and people who are a long way away from the border region. And I think one of the things that comes through in the book that's really striking is that there are an awful lot of people, poor people, who live along the border region who are, in fact, using these drugs.
Yes, and I think my point really is that this is accounting for a lot of the killing for two reasons. A, because these little turfs have been set up between colonias and street corners, and also because, for want of a better way of putting it, they're out of their heads most of the time. The backdrop to this, and this is something that's important, and you know, there is a constituency on the left that think this is all this is explained by economic conditions and poverty, and I'm not convinced by that either. But there is this sociological development, which is the arrival of the maquiladoras, they're called, their bonded assembly plants, which produce stuff duty-free for the United States. So it's like having the third world on your doorstep. And people came in vast numbers to work on the border, not to cross it, but to stay on it and work on the Mexican side in these assembly plants. no infrastructure was established to light their homes, feed them, and crucially to school their children. They don't go to school, these kids. Because the transport systems are too messed up, or because they don't want to, or they can't. And what's happened is that these factories have started now to shed labor. They can do it cheaper in the Mexican interior, or Central America, or even Asia. And you've got now this sort of, for want of a sick way of putting it, a sort of labor pool, if you like. And usually when places deindustrialize, like where my dad's come from in South Wales, or parts of the so-called Rust Belt in the U.S., there are just no jobs. But where there are drugs, there are always jobs. So that addiction becomes a kind of activity in the marketplace. You start off being paid in kind to do something, you cut it, you sell on, you become an addict. And then the pay scale in this business is that then you may want to drive a kidnap getaway car or someone get involved in a kidnapping. And, of course, the highest pay grade in that world is killing. So there is a terrible, there's a chapter in the book called The Urban Frankenstein. Not my term, it's that of a friend and colleague of mine. This sort of urban monster that's been built because of these factories and in the wake of the departure of many of them, with nothing to do but get involved in the drug business, because it's the biggest business in town in some of these places now. And all this is connected. And this, as you say, David, thank you, you know, this is the reason why these children are taking drugs from the age of 10 or so onwards. It's misery, and it's self-obliteration, and it's obliteration, and it's certainly not recreation. Yeah.
Let's talk with someone else here in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. If marijuana was legalized, wouldn't that take millions out of the hands of the narco-terrorists and thus weaken their ability to wage this war?
Well, sir, no, thank you. Yes, it probably would. But most of the damage involves hard drugs rather than marijuana, and I think, you know, marijuana, I'm told it's extremely strong and it can be very dangerous. But then so can alcohol. I think there probably is a qualitative difference between marijuana and the sort of drugs I'm talking about. The ravages, for sure, are those of crack, methamphetamine, crystal meth, crack, and heroin. Though, if you legalize marijuana, yes, you will take some of the trade will go. If you legalize marijuana in some parts of the United States and not in others, then presumably a whole lot of people who, you know, will drift rather like Amsterdam in Europe and go there, and you'll have sort of, you know, marijuana tourism. And yes, you're right. It will take some of the money out, but it won't get to the real root of the problem of the devastation and the violence that is being caused by the hard drugs.
And aren't the vast majority of weapons sold from the United States to Mexico courtesy of the NRA, and therefore they're unregulated? And,
yes, indeed, sir. Thanks. I mean, one of the there is a term that's come into the language, the Iron River, and this, I think, is one of the biggest political developments we've had in the language that the United States is using. Mr. Inge earlier referred to the demand in the United States, and there is also this question of weapons. Secretary of State Clinton has used this term, as has President Obama, co-responsibility. There is a co-responsibility. This is a lot of people in America want to get high, and it is, as you say, it is no disadvantage to the cartels and the killers that the four states that border Mexico have gun ownership and gun culture as crucial to their identity. You know, well, people down there get a bit fed up with Europeans whinging about guns. I mean, this is Texas, like it or love it kind of thing. And so, you know, it is people's right to carry a weapon for hunting or whatever. But, you know, 90% of the guns that have been found in terrible massacres in Mexico and are traced back to the United States, most of them to Texas. I went to a gun show that was 4 miles from the border in Far, and you could buy AR-13s and all these semi-automatic weapons. And surprise, surprise, at the end of the hall is a bookshop selling manuals on how to convert in a few easy steps your semi-automatic AR-13 into the fully automatic model. And the Zetas, who are literally 5 miles away from these gun shows, sort of this little disclaimer at the end of the book saying, you know, you're not allowed to do this without authorization from a federal agency, so do not try this at home kind of thing. But of course this is a huge advantage to the cartels. The most heavily armed of the narco cartels is the Gulf cartel, with this paramilitary wing that it has, and they've also getting a lot of military grade weapons which come from Central America. Yes, I think a lot more could be done. The ATF is trying to do its best. There's a very good man in Houston. There's a thing called Operation Gunrunner going on now. And I think this is very important, very, very salient. Not as important, I don't think, as the hundreds of billions of dollars of drug profits swilling around the banks. To me, that is grotesque, absolutely grotesque.
All right, let's talk. I want to thank the caller. We'll talk with someone next in Normal. Line two. Hello.
Good day. Excellent program. I had come across some information. I wondered if what you thought about it was that now, like during like you mentioned the banks and their connection here, that there's banks that get involved, businesses that get involved with the cartels to help them hide their cash or launder it or whatever, but that now that in Afghanistan too, that there's activity there with that area, but then also too that during the bank crisis there was a moment of time where the banks had to turn to their drug lords because that was the only one that had the cash at the time. And really that what we've seen is that our economy is being backstopped at times with the drug cartels. They were part of the bailout and contributed to keeping it going. I wonder what you – it's an interesting idea because at a crucial moment, they're like, nobody else can get us the cash today. We need the cash today to cover these shorts and these crooked bets. And really what is it's an unholy alliance between the banks and the drug cartels. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Well, you know anything about that?
Well, you raise a crucial point. You know, the work I try to do for this book is sort of street-level eye view. It's reportage from the ground. This is the higher ground. I'd prefer to it on the very last page. But this is where law enforcement wants to go, sir, if if I may say so, and thank you for raising it. There was a moment back to that 2008 crash to which you refer, when a man called Antonio Maria Costa, he's the head of the United Nations Drug and Crime Office, which is based in Vienna in Austria. And he did suggest that the only sort of ready cash that was readily available for banks, as it were, to lend to one another was, he said it's criminal money. There is a mind-boggling amount of criminal money swilling around the banking system. A settlement involving this showed that the banks are not necessarily doing all they can to immediately pounce on apparently dodgy and dirty money, blood money, you could call it if you want. And I think you have a point, and this is not just our supposition. Mr. Costa, who knows his stuff, has researched this quite deeply, has suggested the same thing, at a time when these vast sums of money and indeed the money to be made from processing these kinds of money. I mean, the recent bank settlement, we're talking about $376 billion in 4 years. That's a lot of cash, and it is a brave person to start refusing this money. It has to be said that the parent bank that bought that, which is involved in this case I'm referring to, the prosecutors were anxious to point out that they had behaved absolutely properly, and most banks do. Let's be absolutely clear about that, especially the parent bank involved in this settlement I'm talking about. The impropriety is not universal. It is rogue. But the amounts of money are hard to say no to. Let's put it that way. And I'm citing Mr. Costa of the UN in that. You're onto something, sir. Yes.
We are a little bit past our midpoint. Our guest is Ed Volume. He was the New York correspondent for The Observer, the British newspaper, from 1997 until 2003. He also spent many years as an international correspondent for The Guardian. Has a lot of experience covering conflict. And his new book is titled A Mexica, War Along the Borderline. It's published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, and is the process of a lot of traveling that he did along the border between Mexico and the United States to try to understand this region, its unique character, and also to look at the problem of violence, particularly violence that one way or another is connected with the importation of illegal drugs. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and you can also email will-talk@illinois.edu. It seems that there was a big increase in violence starting at right near the end of 2006, and that it was a result of the government's decision, the government of Felipe Calderon, his decision to try to crush the drug cartels with overwhelming force, and to start using the Mexican military, and it seems that it hasn't worked. What it has done is it certainly bumped up the level of violence. Why did the Calderon government decide to take this much more aggressive stance? And then perhaps the question would be also, well, why did it not work?
Well, indeed, thanks. I mean. Very briefly, and this is a summary needs must. The Sinaloa cartel, led by a man, as you may have heard of, called Joaquin El Chapo Shorty Guzman, in effect saw himself as the heir to what had become a sort of a fragmented monopoly cartel from the old days of the Don, if you like, when the cartel saw it as their business to light the village and provide flowers for women on Mother's Day and so on. That's all gone. The cartel's fragmented for complicated reasons. And Guzman basically laid claim to the frontier and started to pick off the different factions who had their allocated bits of turf, the Arellano Felix brothers in Tijuana. There was violence there in the early 90s, Juarez in the mid-90s. Crucially, in about 2004-05, he wanted to take out and appropriate for himself the busiest border crossing in the world between Nuevo Laredo in Tamaulipas, the state of Tamaulipas, and Laredo, Texas, a couple of dusty towns through which 40% of all the trade that crosses the frontier moves. It's an extraordinary place of trucks and railway yards and forwarding yards. And he took on the Gulf Cartel in whose territory this was. He failed. The Gulf Cartel saw him off. But the level of violence escalated so ferociously that Felipe Calderón, within a few days of taking office, dispatched the troops into Nuevo Laredo and into his home state of Michoacán, where another cartel called La Familia was causing all kinds of rumpus and trouble and killing. The idea was to bring the cartels to heel and to militarize the police force, because the police forces, the various stratum of police, municipal, state, federal, were riddled with infiltration by the different cartels. Some police forces were at the service and pleasure of the cartels. I mean, when I was down in Tijuana, there was a shootout between some officers who had 13 narcos in their truck. They were ambushed. Some of the narcos got away. The ambush was managed by another lot of police working for a rival cartel. Absurd. So the idea was to militarize the police, which has happened in Tijuana, and it's actually produced relative order there compared to some of the other places. It didn't work. It was like a Newtonian reaction. The more force went in, the more the force came back. Juarez, Ciudad Juarez opposite El Paso, wave upon wave of reinforcements went in. And every time that the military was reinforced, the violence got worse. I think one of the reasons is the strategy was, and in many ways the strategy is actually echoed by some thinking in the United States as well, that if you fragment it, if you sort of smash the ball of mercury, and it goes off into lots of little balls of mercury, you strengthen the hand of the authorities. The reverse proved to be the case. The cartels, their corporations, I wouldn't say like any other, but they are often pioneers of a corporation in the modern way of things. They've outsourced, like any other company, they've outsourced to the street gangs to fight for the tenders, for the smuggling routes. And how does a street gang do that? So this fragmentation, and I think this was the miscalculation, this fragmentation has created more violence, not less. There was this fundamental premise that if you whacked them, all the little component parts would dissipate, and you'd lose the sort of the command structure that created the violence in the 90s. Well, the command structure in some places has gone. Juarez has imploded. And instead, you've got a sort of, what some people call a criminal anarchy, a sort of ferocity all over the place, which cannot be controlled. And as a friend of mine said with a wry smile, as you did, Juarez, what drug lord or anyone would want to try and control this? As news of another 13 dead that day came in. Incidentally, again, don't want to spoil people's morning coffee, but we're talking two decapitated bodies in a car with the heads on the hood. It's that kind of grotesque, sick, almost sort of humor to the way they do these things.
We have some other callers, so we'll bring them, bring some more people into the conversation. And the next in line is in Champaign, and this is line one.
Hello there.
Yes.
What about the possibility of American training of the cartel groups through the schools of the Americas, Fort Hood, Puebla, the Cayman Islands, and other places throughout South America, the supply of American military goods to the cartel, and why not control that? And is there a possibility of disrupting everything by having the American government being the sole buyer of these terrible drugs and then supplying them to freely to people who are stupid enough to register and want to wipe out their minds? I'll hang up and listen.
So, yes, a sort of U.S. government nationalized monopoly business importing drugs for sale to people who, as you say, are stupid enough to want to take them. Well, no idea is going to be kicked off the table in this situation. It would be quite a step. I can't see it happening. That the government would want to sort of get involved in something equivalent to a wartime food administration, almost, or a dark twist upon it, take the drugs out of the hands of the criminal. So it's a sort of monopoly, government monopoly legalization of the drug trade. I can't see it happening, sir. But no idea. No idea. I think should be kicked off the table. That one. That's a very bold U.S. administration that takes that on. I suppose I have to say I get back to the point about legalization. If you're regulating something and selling it at a certain price, you don't necessarily guarantee against the criminal syndicates coming up with a stronger drug at a lower price. One of the things about all this, I'm trying to make this point, is that we have here a sort of grotesque pastiche of the legal market. Ciudad Juarez, is nothing if not a temple to free enterprise. It always has been. During Prohibition, it was where you could go and buy your alcohol or have it exported into the United States if you wanted to. You could buy a lot else besides, as everybody knows. The narco cartels, and I think this is important, they're not just pastiches of corporations. They're almost pioneers of it in some ways. We have NAFTA. We have the North American Free Trade Agreement, with all the debates about its pros and cons. In a way, these cartels were NAFTA before NAFTA. They had to be that by definition. They were Pan-American multinationals. And I can't see the U.S. government really returning to a sort of, operating a drug monopoly, although, they have messed around with these things before, and we recall the Iran-Contra episode where the Contras in Nicaragua had to be paid in a currency that wouldn't show above board, and that currency was cocaine, which actually, in retrospect, proved to be more important than it might have seemed at the time, because that very much strengthened the hands of the Mexican cartels against the Colombian, their Colombian customers, if you like. So with what was called the Mexican trampoline, they said they were the middlemen in all that. No idea is crazier than what's going on at the moment. I can't see that one happening.
Hmm. Let's go to another caller here. Let's go to Champaign County, line two. Hello.
I agree with you. We shouldn't dismiss what may be sounding like rather bizarre scenarios. I think we should question whether the Merida initiative doesn't have a lot of comparison to the Colombia interventions by the U.S. that partially as a cover, the drug war is a good cover for interventions against other actors. But that's not what moved me to call. Actually, I was in the documentary record at the time of NAFTA, and I confess I didn't listen to the very beginning of the show, so I don't know if you actually talked about the structural readjustment, if you will, of the peasant economy and how much that's disrupted the economy of Mexico and how that has been fertile for other illicit enterprises and sort of pushing people into a drug economy in a way. At the time of NAFTA, there was sort of an acknowledgement that there was border was going to get fierce because it included some language about reinforcing the border, even at the very beginning. So it seems to me that this shows that movers and shakers knew how disruptive this was going to be. At least maybe they rationalized it in the short term, but it hasn't turned out that way. And just wondered if you could comment on that sort of perhaps a broader analysis.
Yes, no, thank you very much, because you raise crucial sort of the riptide causes really sort of underneath the everyday discourse. yes, NAFTA did it benefited some, but it did have some very negative impact on some of the stabilities and the structures of life in Mexico. Not least the fact that, this wasn't just NAFTA. This was the Mexican government doing it themselves. I don't buy into this narrative that everything bad that happens in Mexico is the fault of the United States, which you hear sometimes. They abolished, for instance, these little bits of collective land called the ejidos, where villagers people could feed themselves and sell some produce. All that was privatized, the collective land, invariably bought up by large, by party cronies or multinational agro businesses. And all this destabilized Mexico a lot, as you say, producing an appetite for drugs, increasing the ranks of the people who want to sell them, as does all sort of disruption of this kind. If you look at the deindustrialization of parts of the United States or of Britain, no one really foresaw, well, I think many of us did, I think, I'm sure you did, foresaw that these social adhesives are very important, be they coal mines, factories, collective lands or whatever. They hold society together, and if you just smash it all up and sell it all off, close it all down, you create, you know, social dislocation. You create a feral society, and NAFTA played its part in that. That's absolutely right. There's another connection, which is that I think sometimes when people think about drugs smuggling into the U.S., they have this idea of some people humping around the backpacks on full of drugs on their back. Dodging the agave cactuses. It's not like that. And the vast majority of the hard drugs come through the ports of entry, and most of those, a lot of those, come through these crossings of Nuevo Laredo into Laredo, Texas. I mean, I spoke to people who described the Zetas just arriving in SUVs, Suburbans, with Kalashnikovs and ski masks, and just saying, "Open the door." And, you know, what truck driver or shuttle dispatcher or even customs officer is not going to open the door? That's how it was put to me. So there is a real dilemma in terms of, you know, as you say, the harshness of the border and the porosity of the border. More and more trade from China that comes into Mexico and comes up through by rail into the U.S. More and more traffic, more and more people, more and more trade. But as you have more and more trade, you know, more and more contraband. Between Los Dos Laredos, the two Laredos, they operate a kind of ambassadorial system. Each city has a representative in the city hall of the others. It works very well, very good. And the man who represents Nuevo Laredo in Laredo, Texas, he estimates 3% is contraband. Well, it's only 3%, but 3% of $350 billion worth of trade is a hell of a lot of contraband. So, of course, there's a connection between the free trade agreement and the drug trade, both sort of structurally and literally on the ground. It comes through in the trucks and aboard the trains.
Our guest in the Central Road Focus is journalist Ed Valumy. His book, it's just recently out, it's titled A Mexica, War Along the Borderline, Ferrer, Strauss, and Giroux is the publisher. We have about 7-8 minutes left. We'll try to get it one more question at least here from a caller. Spring Bay, line 4, hello.
Good morning. I've never been to Mexico. Nonetheless, I have an opinion which I'd like to express and get your response to. I think it was the PRI has been in power or was in power for 70 straight years. And I think that as a result of that, there was an oligarchy developed and corruption. Mexico has been exporting to the United States 3 million barrels of oil every day. That there's wealth in that country. There's something there, but that it has not been equitably shared. They haven't built an economy or an infrastructure to provide employment, and that is part of the problem. And I'll hang up and listen to your more nuanced response. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and thank you, sir, because this is again a crucial point. Yes, the PRI, that's the oxymoronic title, it's called the Institutional Revolutionary Party. They ruled for, as you say, 72 years. They created this system of patronage, and were very much actually in terms of the narco cartels. That was the sort of, if you like, the classical era of the cartels. The cartels knew their place, the politicians knew their place, the police forces used their place, and it was an attempt to sort of break up that oligarchy by Vicente Fox, the first PAN, the more modernizing sort of the new capitalistic party, if you like, less oligarchic, less rigid, and that it was hoped would create some of the changes that we thought desirable. It hasn't happened that way because of the fragmentation I've described in society and economically. But the one thing, and let's end on an up if we can, or at least go towards the end. It is a wonderful country. Why this matters is because the borderland and Mexico, it's fabulous. The people are wonderful. And we must also talk about the resistance. It's not unopposed, all this. We talked about the army and the police. The real resistance to this comes from, it's a hyper-materialist war. It belongs to a belligerent hyper-materialist era. Comes from the priests, the pastors, incredibly brave. The both Catholic and Reformed, And the media is secular and slightly ill at ease with this, but, you know, they're extraordinarily brave. And it's a male war, very much male. We haven't talked about the murders of the women in Ciudad Juarez. And it is opposed by women, organized women and women in the home. Very moving, very brave, humblingly brave people. So, yes, I'm only saying this because you've never been to Mexico. The reason this matters is because there is so much to lose. Mexico is such a wonderful place. The borderland is so rich. And, you know, I care a lot. I don't, when I talk to students about this, I think it would be an awful bequest if the generation that is growing up now became the first in the history of this border, in the history of that between the United States and Mexico, not to have this place where the two cultures come together and the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. Because that's the risk. That's the porosity of that border, apart from the trade, the cultural porosity, is under threat with all this. And that would be a terrible, terrible loss.
We have 2-3 minutes here. I do want to come back to a point that you just have now mentioned in passing, and that's violence against women. And we have talked a lot about violence and that the fact that a lot of it are members of drug gangs warring against one another and fighting over turf, sometimes on a very small level. And I don't think that anybody thinks that all of these women have died have been members of drug gangs. It's a bizarre kind of collateral damage that is perhaps not directly related to the drug trade, but is related.
And it's a very, very important point. There's a very good anthropologist called Cecilia Bailly at UT Austin who talks about the nature. That it's called the feminicidio, the feminicide. And we're talking here, by the way, about the mass abduction, mutilation, torture, sometimes violation and murder of women. Often they worked in these maquila assembly plants that I've talked about. Initially, the majority of the workforce was female. It's now about 50-50. So you had a situation where the young woman in the family earned a wage, went out to work, went out with her friends, and the man had nothing to do. And it was sort of, Ugo, why haven't you got a job? Well, we got a job for you. You can help out with our drug business. This became hugely cogent and created this awful misogynist violence. It's by either the anthropologist. She talks about that this is as a sort of rehearsal for the nature of the violence, the nature of the cruelty, a crisis of masculinity. And, of course, these women had nothing to do with the drug trade. They were factory girls. And this was one of these appalling episodes. And it hasn't gone away, by the way. It just isn't the headlines anymore. It's just not the worst part. It still goes on all over Mexico. There's an article in a Mexican magazine called Proceso recently about the intensification of general violence against women as the narco war escalates. It has that dimension. It's very, very disturbing.
And, again, maybe one more point. We don't have a lot of time, but I was really struck by the fact that this violence had been going on for a long time before it really got significant attention in the American media, and it seemed that this was about 6 months or so ago, and the thing that managed to get the attention of the American media was that some Americans were killed.
Yes, exactly. There was a lot of work done. I mean, yes, it started off in the 90s, and I didn't get to write my first main big article about it until about 2002. It is extraordinary that this level of violence is going to be going on. As I say, and the only reason it matters, it's 10 minutes walk across a bridge from cities in Texas, or across a footbridge from Tijuana into San Diego, which is one of the loveliest cities in America. And this kind of violence, of this intensity, at this level, literally a walk away from America. It's you can't talk about it enough.
Yeah, and at the same time, as you've said, with all this talk about violence, we would want them to understand. I'm sure you'd want them to understand. This violence is not occurring everywhere. It seems particularly to be concentrated in certain places, and particularly it seems to be along the border between Texas and Mexico, but also some on the Pacific coast. So it's not as if this is going on all along the U.S.-Mexico border.
No, it's not, and there are places where there's hardly anything happens, no threat whatsoever. Mexicali, which is opposite Calexico in California, is drug war. What drug war? It's a place called Piedras Negras, which is opposite Eagle Pass in Texas. It's a lovely place. It's almost capricious. It's weird. It's slightly whimsical. Having said that, however, it is spreading across other parts of Mexico. Parts of the Gulf Coast having it, Acapulco and Cancun, which we know of as tourist destinations, they're having problems. So But it is focused on the border, but not all along the border. It's different in different places, and that was the main thing that I learned by doing it all, you know, in these trips.
Yeah. So clearly, this is a place that has really captured you, and it's an interest that maybe now has been going for a while. And in fact, you live now part of the year in Arizona?
Yes, I do when I can. It's so beautiful. This matters.
Well, that's another important point that, again, we get lost in talking about this orgy of violence and this problem, and it's certainly a problem. But at the same time, it's as you have said, it's an extraordinarily much of this region is an extraordinarily beautiful place.
It's physically beautiful. The space is beautiful. The light is sumptuous. The people are friendly. The smile is a willing one. The welcome is ready. And these is where the brightnesses of the colors get more lambent as the situation gets darker and scarier. That's the oddity of it. They're wonderful people. It's a wonderful place. Anyone who lives near the border, visited regularly, has the fondest memories of going, getting, I don't know, having lunch, brunch, teeth fixed, having fun in these places. There was a sleazy fun, of course, and actually one shouldn't really put it this way, but one of the more beneficial side effects of this is that the ghastly kind of sex tourism that used to take place has fizzled out, as people don't think it's worth the risk. But it's a richness to the place. It's heart-stoppingly physically beautiful, yeah. And it's a nice place to be. However, one is not able to sort of really say to people, Ciudad Juarez is okay, go and enjoy it. One cannot recommend a relaxed weekend in some of these places, Reynosa, Matamoros. Some of them are okay. Mexicali's okay, Piedras Negras is okay, but I don't want to be a hostage to fortune and have people sort of say, oh, I heard on the radio it's okay to go there and something awful happened.
Yeah. Well, there we'll have to leave it. More can be found in the book A Mexica, War Along the Borderlines, published by Ferro Strauss. You wrote by our guest, Ed Volumy. And thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Darren. Thank you to you all. A very great pleasure.